Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. This court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060372, Columbia Rio Grande Healthcare versus Alice H. Holly and James A. Holly from Hidalgo County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 070055, In Re Gulf Exploration and Others, which is an original proceeding. And docket number 070091, Trammell Crow Central Texas Limited versus Maria Gutierrez and others from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument and expects to complete all well before noon. We will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060372, Columbia Rio Grande Healthcare versus Alice and James Holly.
The court, Mr. Watson will present argument for the petitioner, and the petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Skip Watson and Mike Hatchell for Columbia Rio Grande Healthcare. The Court of Appeals has held that the trial court did not need to submit what this court has held is the ultimate causation issue when survival is at issue. Whether the chance of survival is greater than 50% at the time of the defendant's alleged negligence. It gave essentially two reasons. I suspect we're here because of the first. They said it's absolutely clear that it did not need to submit it because of the absence of precedent saying that an instruction was necessary. But it's the second reason that concerns me the most. And that is, they said that it would not have assisted the jury because that ultimate issue of chance of survival being greater than 50% was inherent in the causation instruction that was given. So there was no basis to conclude that it was necessary to enable the jury to reach a verdict. To me, that raises a deeper question that is at the core of broad form charge practice that only this court can decide. And that question is simple. Do judges or do attorneys tell the jury what the controlling issue is under the law and what factors they can consider under the law in deciding that issue? That question must be decided.
Why doesn't the proximate cause definition take care of it? If it does in fact mean that it's more likely than not that the negligence caused her death?
Your Honor, I understand that it could be interpreted as saying that, but it's very similar to what Justice Hecht had dealt with in Reinert in his concurring opinion. You can work a way where a lawyer could figure out that it would be in there, but it is inscrutable to a juror. That's what Justice Willett and the court just dealt with in Ford versus Ledesma.
What's inscrutable about more likely than not?
Because you've just said in Ford that there are two discrete elements to factual causation, not just more likely than not just but for, but also substantial factor. Let me go through just quickly the practical reasons why the charge precludes the argument of counsel from directing the jury's attention to the ultimate issue rather than having the court do that. First, they were instructed in the charge to follow only what the court said concerning what the law was. They are to follow only what the court said. They are free to disbelieve lawyers. Indeed, they know the lawyers arguing the charge to them are advocates. There is no mention in this charge of substantial factor. It is the same charge out of the PJC on products and malpractice that you dealt with in Ledzma, only without the exciting factors part. All you have is but-for causation. That's the critical issue, is can this core ultimate element of the charge be deciphered by a jury when the court doesn't draw the attention to it? This has been a problem from the get-go of charge practice. Hodges, 50 years ago, lamented in page 30 of his special issues treatise, lamented submitting causation in other terms just in legalese.
If substantial factor had been specifically put into the charge, would you also need the lost chance instruction? And if so, why?
Yes, you would. The reason is this. You have to draw the jury's attention to what is being asked. It's the same reason, for example, in inferential rebuttal instructions that this court has consistently held that if they're raised by the evidence, they must be submitted. Our entire unbroken body of charge jurisprudence is that you can't just assume that the jury can figure out from the charge that it doesn't have to put negligence on somebody.
But why doesn't substantial factor just by definition mean more than 50%?
I think it should mean more than 50%. But the jury doesn't know that that's being talked about, that the ultimate issue in the case is going to be determined by whether she had greater than a 50% a chance of survival. They need the court to tell them, you are deciding the issue on these factors. Otherwise, again, it's lawyers, not the court, telling the jury, under the law, this is what you're deciding here. I cannot conceive of this court warning a laissez-faire jury system where the court gives what I think Justice Willett called it, not in concrete terms.
There's a bit of a problem with your argument because when you go through the pattern jury charge, we've done a study. California has done a study and looked at the sorts of questions that we ask today of jurors. And jurors don't, in general, understand. And so they rely on the lawyers to sort of elaborate on the concepts of negligence and what a marketing defect is, and the lawyers then can object to each other about whether that accurately states the law. So if we accept your argument that the instruction here on proximate cause wasn't enough, would it be incumbent on the court then to go through and elaborate on all of these technical terms in our charge instructions?
I don't know about all of the technical terms in all of the charge instructions. I do know that when the ultimate issue is something like either an inferential rebuttal, that is, telling the jury you don't have to blame anybody in this case, or when it's an ultimate issue of something as technical as causation is going to be determined by whether this person has a chance of survival greater than 50%, and you've got to focus on that and find it. This court has consistently said that those things, if raised by the evidence, must be submitted. And I don't see any reason to distinguish this from an inferential rebuttal issue. It's the same principle. Who is going to guide the jury? It may be a problem in terms of every discrete case, but it's not a problem in this case. This case, all the court had to do was grant the issue right under it, just like an inferential rebuttal issue would have been done, and allow the jury to be told that in considering this one, you must determine whether the person had greater than 50% right of survival.
Let's presume that the trial court erred in failing to submit the instruction. Why would that be reversible error when the counsel apparently agreed and stated to the jury that they had to meet a greater than 50% burden?
There's no question that it was argued, Your Honor. Absolutely no question about that. Part of the problem is we really can't tell. There's no way of knowing that, as in Castile, Harris County, the other cases, it is impossible to know that this jury decided the case on an issue that was the proper legal issue for it to be decided on. It's impossible to know that unless the court drew the line to it. That was the point that was being made when we talk about that the element has to be submitted. I mean, you said that in Diamond Offshore. You said it in Keach versus Kroger. You've said it in Reinhart. You've said it in case after case, specifically going back to the beginning of broad form in Scott versus Atchison, Topeka, act of God, inferential rebuttal. The court made the point that the instruction not only should be given, but needs to be tied in to the element that it's talking about.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
It sounds like you would even argue for submission of a question to the jury as to the probability of survival.
Give us not at all.
45%. Well, you just said it was impossible to tell if the jury based its decision on this issue on a proper factual determination supported by the law. The way to know is to ask the jury what percentage, what chance of survival there was, right?
Of course you would know that. But at least, and this is the point I believe.
I'm asking if you think it's necessary. Do you think it would be error to submit such a question, asking the jury for the number that represents the chance of survival?
I certainly don't think it's ever error to submit a granulated question, but I want to be crystal clear. It's not necessary. This court has never held that it's reversible error to submit a granulated question. I know of no such case. But what's at issue here is, and that's what Justice Heck's concurring opinion in Reinhart made crystal clear, is that you've got to be able to tie the jury's answer on negligence and causation to the proper legal standard. And they don't have the proper legal standard unless the court tells them. Now, if this court wants lawyers to tell juries what the law is that controls their decisions and what the factors are that they considered, it should say so. But in Spencer versus Eagle Star, it drew a bright line and said, for example, in areas of bad faith insurance practices, we are not just going to ask that issue. It's got to be hemmed in. And that's the job of courts, not juries, to decide what the law is. And that is critical to the function of broad form practice. We cannot know what the jury decided in this case. But to answer Justice Wainwright's question, if there had just been an instruction, we would know. Without it, we cannot possibly know. Last, in the few seconds I have left, I want to make crystal clear that on the inferential rebuttal instruction of independent cause, this case is not due, but it can clarify due. In this case, the restatement factors that Justice O'Neill listed in Fan were met in terms of it being truly independent, in terms of it being operating independently due to a third party's failure to act, due to the third party.
Well, but it has to be unforeseeable as well.
That is correct, Your
Honor.
And
doesn't the hospital's policy that incorporated this redundancy, and I realize there's some disagreement, but the policy required an oral notification, fax notification, certified mail notification. Doesn't that mean that the treating physician may not be informed of the PATH results, particularly in a case like this where they weren't looking for colon cancer, but they were performing another procedure and might not know to follow up? So this redundant policy in itself, doesn't that imply it's foreseeable that the doctor would not get the report?
And certainly that should have been argued if it had been, if we had been allowed to submit our evidence. But this is a Dresser case, not a Due case. This is a case like Dresser where we were prohibited from bringing in our evidence. There was a limine where we couldn't even mention the word negligence. And what our evidence in the bills was trying to show was that there, that we, yes, assumed this duty to try to deliver, but that once they had access, once it was in the chart, once the green card came back from the primary treating physician, that duty had been met. Second, and more important, that this was truly a superseding duty on the part of the doctors. What our evidence was trying to show was that the doctors cannot sit back and wait for the fax machine to ring or to wait for the mail to arrive, that they have an ongoing duty to find out.
But I thought the record was pretty replete with evidence that doctors did not do that, and therefore this policy was put into place. That there was difficulty, whether it's the doctor's fault or the hospital's fault, but there was always difficulty in making sure these reports got through, whose ever fault it was, and therefore it's the reason you have this policy. And so it just, the policy itself would seem to indicate foreseeability.
I understand that the policy itself was designed to try to have redundant ways to give the doctors access to the information. But again, the evidence that we were prepared to submit was like Dresser, where the court recognized that even though there's a warning label and there's a failure to do a warning label, that there are circumstances when the failure to have that warning label can still be overcome by an inferential rebuttal situation. In that case, sole cause. This case, when it goes back, may well end up as a sole cause case. I don't know how it will shake out. I understand, this case was tried prior to due.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Watson. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Walker will present argument for the respondent.
Thank you. With respect to the absence of an additional instruction that proximate cause in this case required that Mrs. Hawley have a greater than 50% probability of survival, as we pointed out in our brief, the court, or rather the charge, instructed the jury that a yes answer had to be based on a preponderance of the evidence. The preponderance of the evidence meant the greater weight and degree of credible evidence that the hospital's negligence could not be a proximate cause unless it was a cause which in a natural and continuous sequence caused the event, and without which...
It might have been helpful in this case. I mean, the Court of Appeals says this is what the trial was really about, whether her chances were already below 50% or not.
That was absolutely the central issue in the case.
And, you know, you read the Court of Appeals opinion, and you get the impression that they're not going to make a step away from the pattern jury charge. Because they're afraid of getting reversed. Wouldn't it have made, don't we need to say something to tell folks, look, if the case is about one thing, don't submit 37 other issues just because they're in the pattern jury charge. Why don't you submit the one thing that the case is about? Wouldn't that be a better way for the world to work?
Well, Your Honor, the pattern jury charge does instruct the jury that death had to be more likely than not. The lawyers
in
the case...
There was reason it did that before we had the cases reversing people, telling them that's what it means. So at least a lot of lawyers in courts, until we did so, didn't think that's what it meant, right?
Well, actually...
Why are the jurors in Hidalgo County more sophisticated than the lawyers who lost those cases right up here?
Well, actually, as I recall, in the Kramer case, the charge submitted the standard wrongful death cause, And the plaintiff had requested an additional instruction that asked, okay, if you find no, it didn't cause the death, did it cause a reduction in her chance of survival? And the court refused that, and this court said that was right because the Wrongful Death Act requires that it cause death, and it can only cause death under the preponderance of the evidence standard if there was a probability of survival before the act of negligence.
What if it caused quicker death, if it hastened death?
Well, I personally believe that under the Kramer standard, if the defendant's negligence hastened death, probably hastened death, when it otherwise would not have occurred, that would likely survive the Kramer standard. That's not necessarily an issue in this particular case because the evidence in this case was there was evidence from the plaintiff that there was a greater than 50% probability of survival if the hospital had not been negligent. And then the converse evidence from the defendant was, no, there wasn't. She was destined to this result regardless of our negligence. So we didn't have this situation where everyone agreed she would die in 10 years, but the hospital intervened, and therefore she died immediately.
Well, that is something that the Court of Appeals looked at, and both legally and factually sufficient, on more than or less than 50%. That is clearly an issue in the case that's going to be evaluated here. Now, if we have the Court of Appeals looking at it, and if we're here arguing about it here, why would it not help the jury to tell the jury what the test is? Seems like, you know, what the standard is. Seems like we're asking the jury to give an answer, and then we tell them the question later on, or at least we argue about the question. We never did tell the jury the question. Why would it not help them if, in fact, that's what the case is about, to give them, for the court to tell them, here's what the case is about?
Well, Your Honor, I think that probably any broad form submission charge could include additional instructions that would refine, define, expand upon.
But we're talking about the one that we're going to measure evidence by on appeal by judges and lawyers arguing about. And we're assuming that the jury will know what it's about, but we haven't told them.
Well, with all due respect, I don't think that under this record there can be much question that the jury did understand that was the issue.
Because that's what the lawyers argued. And well, that's what opposing counsel said. The trial judge didn't tell them, though, and that's what we tell them in the charge. The judge is going to tell them the law. So, and many times, quite frankly, lawyers argue about what the law is or isn't, and the jury gets confused about that. So,
and that's a great point, Your Honor, and that's one reason why in this particular case, regardless of whether the instruction would have been helpful or not, under this record, there can be no probability that it caused the rendition of an improper judgment because this was not a case. First of all, ordinarily you would have broad form jury instructions. The lawyers would then apply those to the evidence, argue about it, explicate it to the jury. In this case, you didn't have a situation where the plaintiff's lawyer was saying, here's the broad form definition of proximate cause or preponderance of the evidence. That doesn't mean 50%. We don't have to prove 50%. We just have to prove it was substantial. And then the defense lawyer objects and says, no, that's not the law. And he says the law is what we say it is. This is a case where the plaintiff's lawyer said, look, preponderance of the evidence, that means we have to show more likely than not she would have survived. That was conceded from the beginning. There was never any question about it. It was argued by both sides. So I'm not trying to evade your question. You asked whether this instruction might have been helpful in this case. I don't think I can in good faith say there's no possibility that it could have been helpful. It could have clarified things. However, under the record in this case, I don't think there's any way it can be considered harmful error under the standard that harmful error in the jury charge means that the omission was probably caused the rendition of an improper judgment because there was no dispute that the preponderance of the evidence standard of proof combined with the definition of proximate cause required the plaintiff to prove that Mrs. Hawley's chance of survival was greater than 50%.
Counsel, do you see any way that the instruction at issue here would have caused harm or confusion in the case? I'm not talking about harmful error, but is there any prejudice or harm that such an instruction could have caused?
Well, I think that the harm that it might cause, and again, I think that probably the probability of this harm is similar to the probability that it would have been helpful. It might have caused harm in the sense that the jury may have seen it as a nudge. Here's the judge telling the jury, first of all, you have to find yes by preponderance of the evidence. It can't be a proximate cause unless it probably led to death. And now, let me say again, don't find for the plaintiff unless you find that it's more than 50%. In some of the inferential rebuttal cases where some of the concurring and dissenting justices have criticized inferential rebuttals, they've made comments like, you know, at best it only repeats what's in the charge. At worst, it could be seen as a nudge to find no negligence. I think you could conceivably have that problem by repeating what is already in the charge in general terms that have been well accepted by the bench and bar for many years in the pattern jury charge. By repeating those with a specific explication, particularly...
So if the judge repeats what you've just argued to us that both sides agreed on, they'll be nudged against you?
Say again, I'm sorry.
You just said both parties in the closing argument are telling the jury that's what this charge meant. And if the judge puts in what both sides are arguing to the jury, how could the jury be nudged by the judge?
Well, because what I'm saying is that the plaintiff is admitting what his burden of proof is. The charge has that burden of proof in general terms. The judge then comes in, not only has the plaintiff admitted that's my burden of proof, but the judge has made the comment, and by the way, don't find for the plaintiff unless. Now, that's not saying that's an incorrect statement of the law, and I'm not saying it would necessarily judge, but it could. And in this particular case, it was unnecessary.
Moving to the independent contractor question. What was the, tell me just first a little bit about the facts. The pathologist does the report.
That's right.
And everybody agrees it's the pathologist's duty to get that report to the doctors who can act upon it.
The policy actually, the pathologist does have a duty. The policy said the pathologist.
So the hospital has a duty also because it undertook it. Or if the hospital had no policy, would it still have a duty to make sure the pathologist is doing his job?
No, I believe
normally they would.
The hospital, in this case, the allegation of negligence was that the hospital failed in its policy to notify the doctor as it and.
So because it had a policy, it undertook. How did it undertake to make sure that the report got? That the pathologist did what they were supposed to do?
Well, remember, the hospital established this policy, and the physicians, Dr. Rodriguez, Dr. Archego, they were aware that this policy existed, and so they relied on that policy. And so when the hospital says, here's our policy, when there's a cancer-positive pathology report, here's what's going to happen. First of all, policy number one is the pathologist will pick up the phone and give you a call. But in addition to that, and because we know this is important, and because we know these are patients admitted to our hospital, and we're also going to fax you the report and send the pathology secretary. And in the
she employee of the hospital.
Yes,
or
she is. She is. And in the record, I'll tell you exactly where it is in the record because I thought about that as I was preparing. Marisol Garcia at volume 7, page 112, she testified that, you know, I was the pathology secretary, I was an employee of the hospital, I was the one who was responsible for faxing. So It was the hospital's employee who was responsible for faxing and sending the certified mail. Now, the pathologist, who was not a hospital employee, was the one responsible for picking up the phone and calling.
As long as we're on that, the policy also said the pathologist will verbally notify the physician's record. That's the hospital policy?
Yes.
And the question we're talking about, was the doctor the hospital's agent?
No, the doctor was not. The doctor...
he was not. You admit he was not, but the hospital policy says the pathologist, one of their policies is pathologist will verbally notify. And as I understand, there's a question about the pathologist verbally notifying in this case.
Well, there was evidence that doctors Arachega and Dr. Rodriguez did not receive verbal notification because the hospital was attempting to put blame on them, and so they had to say, you know, we're not at fault, we didn't get a call, we didn't, so forth. And so they denied receiving notice under any of these things.
So the question I have goes to this. If the hospital's policy says the pathologist is to verbally notify, and that's part of their policy, and there's evidence the pathologist did not, what's to prevent the jury from saying, well, the hospital can't tell the pathologist what to do unless the pathologist is some kind of an agent for the hospital? I mean, you know, that thought process,
well,
which is what the, as I understand it, requested instruction was directed to.
Well, to do that, the jury would have had to have ignored the undisputed evidence in the case that the pathologist was not a hospital employee. That was...
No, we're talking agent. Is there a difference between employee and agent?
I don't think in the tort context that there is. I think it...
Anybody tell the jury that is the question.
Well, I don't think that... The jury charge did not get into that issue about whether an employee is the same thing as an agent. However, the evidence repeatedly said that the pathologist did not work for the hospital. He was not their employee. He just had an office in the hospital. The jury, in the jury arguments, the plaintiff's counsel made no argument about Dr. Valencia failed to call or anything like that. He focused strictly on the failure to fax, failure to do certified mail. When the defense lawyer gave his argument, he said twice, Dr. Valencia wasn't our employee. He wasn't. He didn't work for the hospital. So throughout the trial, the jury heard that Dr. Valencia was not the hospital's employee. And I believe that I don't have the language of the instruction, but I think it said it acts only through its employees, servants, nurses. It may have said agent. I don't
employees,
remember.
Employees, agents, nurses, and servants.
Okay.
In the charge. What was the evidence that he was not the agent? Again, following up on Justice Johnson's question, someone who has an office in the building of the defendant, who's working with the defendant's policies say that this person has to do certain things. A person who's walking in off the street listening to that might conclude that there's some kind of agency relationship there. Maybe they perhaps won't know the legal definition of agent. So what's the evidence that he was not the agent?
Well, the evidence that he was not an agent was the various testimony that he was not an employee or employed by the hospital or worked for the hospital. Now, there was not a requested instruction defining agent. There was no objection to that particular jury instruction that you shouldn't consider the hospital's acts other than their agents, employees, servants, or nurses on the basis that, well, because we have the word agent in there, the jury might be confused. The requested instruction was not to consider Dr. Valencia's conduct, and because the plaintiff's argument never argued about Dr. Valencia's conduct, because it was undisputed Dr. Valencia was not an employee, I think at the very least it was harmless error. One could not say that it is probable that the jury returned a verdict on Dr. Valencia's, based on Dr. Valencia's conduct under the entire record of this case.
And what was the basis of the objection to the instruction? Why was Why was it a bad instruction? Why was it opposed at the trial court?
The basis of the opposition was that it would unduly call attention to Dr. Valencia's conduct.
That was the plaintiff's objection?
Well, that's right. The plaintiff said it wasn't necessary because it undisputed that Dr. Valencia was not the hospital's employee, didn't work for the hospital.
But lawyers know there's a difference between employees and agents. A lot of your points go back to, almost all of them go back to employee, a non-employee status. And then, as you can see, I'm struggling with the agency term, which we know is broader than employee.
Yes.
I'm wondering if there's a proposed instruction. Since everyone agrees that the doctor, the pathologist, was not the employee or the agent of the hospital, and the instruction said don't consider the pathologist's conduct or attribute it to the hospital in effect, I'm again asking, what's the basis for the objection to that instruction? How does it hurt? Everybody agrees he's not the employee or the agent.
Well, again, I'm not necessarily sure that it would have definitely hurt or been harmful to include.
You just don't think it's necessary.
That's right. And particularly under this record, I don't think it could be argued that it was probably caused the rendition of an improper judgment, because no one ever suggested that agent meant something broader than employee, that he was an agent of the hospital. That was never argued. It was never suggested.
Was he sued?
Dr. Valencia? No, I don't believe he was. Now, there were some physicians who were sued and dismissed, so to be candid with you, I don't know 100%, but I don't believe he was. In my last minute, I will go to the intervening cause question, and just wanted to mention one thing, and that is that in counsel's argument, he stressed that we attempted to put on evidence and it was excluded. And the Court of Appeals, they raised an appellate point about that. The Court of Appeals found it was not error to exclude the evidence. And in their brief in the merits in this court, that point was not carried forward. So the question is whether the evidence that was admitted raised the issue of new and independent cause. And as we've briefed, we do not believe that it did, both because it was a foreseeable concurring cause and also because there was no evidence that the consequences of the hospital's negligence were cut off such as to cause a new and different result.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
About the agency servant instruction. The charge read, "You are hereby instructed that Rio Grande Regional Hospital acts or fails to act only through its employees, agents, nurses, and servants." Counsel is correct. Agents, servants, employees is not defined. Therefore, we requested a limiting instruction to follow it immediately. In considering the negligence of Rio Grande Regional Hospital, do not consider the acts or omissions of the pathologist, Dr. Valencia. There were two reasons we requested that. The first is the policy itself. Number one, under reports positive for cancer, that's item two, A is pathologist will verbally notify physicians of record. It's obvious that a verbal notification of cancer is like a brick through a window. It has a tremendous impact. The doctors said they didn't get it. Second, please look at volume 7, pages 82 through 93 of the record, where the doctor was on the stand, Dr. Valencia was on the stand, and was repeatedly questioned about the first, quote, failsafe, to use plaintiff's counsel's words, of the policy, and that it didn't work. Therefore, it was necessary, you see, under their theory, to fax and send by certified mail, because the first failsafe didn't work. That's critical. We had to be able to stop the confusion that when we're being told we assumed a duty by publishing policies and the first policy is a pathologist whom we don't control to tell the jury he is not an agent or servant. I don't even know what a servant is. I don't expect I can. The jury is going to know what it is. They all wear white coats. How are they supposed to differentiate? We need a limiting instruction. Second, on the preponderance of the evidence questions, that begs the question. It's preponderance of the evidence of what? That's what we're here about. What was the charge trying to get at? Let me read you what this court wrote in 1901. It is not to be supposed that the jury considered an issue not developed by the charge of the court. And from that thesis, in the concurring opinion in Reinert v. Young, is the principle that controls this case. While it is true that the general terms in which the court's charge is expressed would, as a matter of law, include something, it is not to be supposed that the jury considered an issue not developed by the charge. It is possible to deduce from standard instructions on ordinary care, negligence, and proximate cause that some accidents are no one's fault. A party is entitled to have that fact pointed out to the jury, untrained in the law. And that's the point on these instructions. A jury untrained in the law cannot be expected to understand what our proximate cause instruction is talking about. You have gone a long way in ICS Cedars and again in Lexima to say you've got to at least add substantial factor. But this case is about whether when the whole issue is whether a person has greater than 50% chance of survival. Whether one, that is an element of causation that must be submitted and found, or at least is the operative ultimate issue in causation that the jury's attention must be drawn to. Again, this case is about whether juries are told what the law is and what the factors that govern their decision are by courts or lawyers. I guarantee you, if you give us that vacuum, we will cheerfully fill it. And I suspect that will be the day broad form, when we look back 50 years from now, is said to have started its decline. The judge cannot put down his or her pencil. They've got to focus the jury on what's at issue. Justice Brister is absolutely correct. It cannot be just, here it is from the PJC, good luck.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
Ayes.
Thank you.